is to cover the last two chapters of Ecclesiastes, so Ecclesiastes 11 and 12. And we'll just kind of dive in. And this is a fun part of Ecclesiastes. The last part is clear. It comes out and gives us the answer, the meaning for life. But there's a few bumps in the text as we go along, a few things that make us scratch our head in a little bit and say, what is Solomon trying to teach us? And so those will be fun for us to tease out this morning. But as we come to the close, I just want to ask one question, and then we'll revisit this question near the end of our time this morning, is what have you learned from Ecclesiastes? And that could be in our time together here or just throughout your Christian life. What have you learned from Ecclesiastes? I want to talk about that collectively. We've mentioned things we've learned. We've seen how it gives us a voice to sort of voice things that sometimes we might keep quiet. We don't want to talk about our frustrations. It brings those to the light. It expresses struggles, the mundane things of life that are difficult. Those are things that have helped us. But let's at the end ask this question, what have we learned? And the good news for us in these last two chapters is that we come up for some air, and I think we see that Ecclesiastes really isn't as depressing as maybe we sometimes think it is. There's some real hope and some brightness in these last verses. Maybe one of the best ways that I've heard, this doesn't come from me, from somebody else, of summarizing these last two chapters is this, that the more alive we are to God, the more alive we are. So again, the more alive we are to God, the more alive we are. I think that summarizes a lot of what we see in these last chapters as we're given the idea that we fear God, and that is the whole of man. And at the same time, we get these pictures of youth and age and how we live and are alive to God in our life. So with that, let's dive in and let's just start picking up some verses here. I'm going to start in chapter 11. Verse 1 is a bit of a head scratcher. Cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. Give a portion to 7 or even to 8, for you know not what disaster may happen on earth. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. And if a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. All right, we'll stop there. 4 verses. Huh? Thanks. If you didn't hear that, Jane said, huh? What's going on? Now, in the context, remember, we're in this moment of getting some actually good advice about how to live our lives in a time of uncertainty. And so Ecclesiastes, in a sense, in these verses 1 through 10, and we'll read the rest in a moment, give this idea of being bold, in the midst of uncertainty because of the Creator that we'll see in a moment. What does it mean to cast your bread on the water? Anybody? It's a little enigmatic. There's really not a strong consensus about it. I think we read that and we scratch our heads and say, what does that mean? Cast your, that sounds like, does that sound like a good idea or a bad idea on
the
surface?
The Gaither band, which is...
Okay, yeah.
You're too young to know that.
No, I know the Gaithers. I don't know there's this song, but I know the Gaithers.
Yeah. It says, cast your cares upon the water and it will come back to you. And they use it in a positive way.
Okay.
So I don't know if it casts what, you know, the good stuff, the bread of life. On the waters and...
Okay. So taking it in a positive way of sort of cast it, see what that happens. Yeah, any other thoughts? What happens to bread when you throw it in the water usually?
It gets soggy.
It's soggy, yes. Yeah. And that's a fair observation. And sometimes when we read scripture, we need to be that obvious and say, okay, what happens to bread? It gets soggy. So there are a few different ways of taking this. And I think it makes more sense when we get into verse 2. And we could, you know, spend all kinds of time on this, but I don't think it's as significant in the flow of the text. One way of taking it is that this is something about trade. Put your bread out in trade on the water, sort of commerce, and it will come back to you. And so some see it as sort of a diversifying of your investments. Go do trade on the water, and that makes a little more sense when you look at verse 3. But the most sort of traditional understanding of this actually has been an idea of giving to the poor, and a sort of reciprocal kindness that happens. And that comes up, and look at verse 2. It says, give a portion to 7 or even to 8, for you know not what disaster may happen on earth. Think of that. Now, that makes sense either in diversifying your investments, right? Give to 7 to 8, have your money spread about. But more often, I think in this text, it's this idea of kindness, in a sense of give to 7 or 8, welcome them to your table so that in the day when your table is empty, there will be food for you. There'll be a table for you to sit at. And so sometimes there are these sort of Hebrew phrases or idioms like cast your bread on the water that just sort of, we don't have a parallel for them in English. And I think that's sort of what's going on. And the original audience would have had a better handle on exactly what was going on here. Yeah, go ahead.
This reminds me, as you're discussing mm-hmm. it, reminds me of Oscar Schindler. He was broke
okay.
by the time he got out and by the time all the stuff
yeah.
was over.
Yeah.
And those people, the ancestors
mm-hmm.
of the people of the lives that he saved,
yeah.
they welcomed him
yeah.
into their home.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, no, I think that's a very fair way of seeing how things work. And so this, and in the context, right now, it's hard to lose the train, or it's easy to lose the train of thought through Ecclesiastes. There has been this sense of how do we make things go well in a time where things are uncertain. These are some ideas here of saying spread your resources, spread them out in a sense, because that will go well for you. We need to go quickly so we get to the good conclusion here. 3 and 4 have this idea of rain. Rain clouds are full, then they empty themselves, and if a tree falls to the north or the south, it probably reminds us of, you know, the joke, the question, does a tree that falls in the wood make noise, right? That's, in a sense, what it's saying is these things happen, and they just happen, and we need to be prepared for that. There's an inevitability to these things, and so how are we going to go about doing things? And so verse 4 says, he who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. Basically, if you keep watching the clouds, you're never going to put a seed in the soil. If you're going to keep waiting for the perfect moment, it's not going to happen. And so, in a sense, as we get to the conclusion, what Solomon is reminding us is even when the world doesn't totally make sense, even when things are confusing and uncertain, there's an appropriateness to be bold and go do something, to go do some work, to go put some seeds in the ground. Have you ever, we probably have some gardeners, right? How attentive are you to the weather when you plant, right? You pay attention to it, but sometimes you just have to put seeds in the ground, right? I'm not a gardener. I don't have that much experience about that. I tried to grow okra one time when we lived in South Carolina, and I got all the advice from a friend and did it properly. But I did have a moment where I was reading on this, right? And I got really into it because I want to make this okra grow well. And I read that the biggest indicator was soil temperature. In terms of when you plant. So I wasn't able to do this because my wife wisely stopped me as I was walking through the house with an instant read thermometer to go put it in the ground. She's like, that doesn't matter. And she was right, it grew just fine. And that's sort of the point. We can obsess over these things and put thermometers in the ground, or we can just trust God and go and grow. And that's what Ecclesiastes is reminding us. We can't control everything. We can trust our Creator, as will come up later in chapter 12, and we can go and be faithful. And that's really where it comes back to again and again, this idea of faithfulness and boldness in moving forward, even in the uncertainty that we face. Yes?
Should we just be more like Megan and just plant seeds?
Yes, yes. Yeah, that was from Men's Bible Study today. Megan, our middle daughter, takes apple seeds and puts them in the backyard, and they start growing. And like, how did this happen? She tends these little piles of dirt in the backyard. So much more haphazard than anyone else, but it works. All right, picking up verse.
Apple trees growing in the backyard.
Well, they're dead now because the lawnmower and stuff. And, yeah.
Dad.
We didn't nurture her nurturing, I guess. Verse 5 of chapter 11. As you do not know the way of the Spirit comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with child, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. Same idea. We don't understand everything. We don't know how life fully comes, especially in this moment in time. And so we do not know the work of God who makes everything. He is the one who is in control. And so we can be bold. We can do things even as we anticipate his work. Verse 6. In the morning, sow your seed, and at evening, withhold not your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, this or that, or whether both alike will be good. Light is sweet, and it is pleasant for the eyes to see sun. So if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all, but let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. all that comes is vanity. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. Remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body. For youth and the dawn of life are vanity. All right, so what does Ecclesiastes do here? A few of those things we already talked about in terms of sowing are noted. The appropriateness of sort of being bold, going and sowing the seed that we need to do. And it does raise the question for us, where in our life do we need to get to work? And that's not a, you know, go punch a time clock, but where do you need to actually be busy? Where do you need to go and say, this is what God is calling me to do. How can I go and do it? It's a not a rhetorical question, but a question meant to sort of just bounce around in our brains for a moment. Because there are things that we probably know that we should be doing, and we don't do it, right? I think that's often the difficulty in Christianity, right? It's not that we don't know what God has asked us to do, it's that we have good reasons, we think good reasons not to do it. And Ecclesiastes, in his own way, sort of counteracts that by saying, yeah, there's uncertainty. There's things that you might think are more important or things that might get in the way, but there's a call to go and sow your seed in the morning, which, you know, we're not literally out there farming, but we have work to do. And Ecclesiastes encourages us to do that. And he does so, verse 7, with this idea that light is sweet and it is pleasant for the eyes to see sun. Now, this is a nice moment, right? Sun comes up, it's light, it's beautiful. We like sun. If you've been outside recently, we know what it's like to be warmed by the sun when it's not, you know, punishing us at 110 degrees, but it's 75 and it's beautiful. That's the picture that is described here. Light really is a metaphor for life. There's this sweetness to it, the pleasantness, this joy in seeing the light in the sun. This is a good gift. And so, if a person, verse 8, lives many years, let him rejoice in them all. Now, this is interesting. So there's light, there's sun, life. We're supposed to rejoice in that every day of our life. And then it says, remember that the days of darkness will be many. So how do those things fit together? How do we understand that?
To me, I get the picture of a life grounded in the Lord, a thoughtful life, something that is deliberate, that you go, you do what you need to do, you look at life, go, okay, this God's in control, I am not. But fully grounded, appreciating the moments that we have. And I too often whine about them. So it's not like I have this, but we've all met people that have just this groundedness in the Lord, that live their lives thoughtfully and to the fullest.
No, I think that's really, and what everything you said there doesn't negate that there are dark days, right? And I think that's what Ecclesiastes is offering us, is saying there is this light, this sun, this joy in God's good world, and there are the dark days. He's not negating them, but did you notice the fact that we are, let him rejoice in all of them, right? All the days, all the years of his life, and some of those years are actually going to be days of darkness. And so he's not negating that, but I think you're absolutely right. This grounding in God and who he is and in his light gives us the ability to look at our dark days with a different perspective, a different reality. And this is one of those verses that it's easy to understand and then we have to go live it, right? And it's a little bit harder to go and live this, isn't it? How do we live this reality of seeing the light of all of our years, but knowing that many days are dark or evil?
Well, we're living in a fallen world. We're fallen beings, and so, you know, God's, through the sanctification process, he's refining us, right? Getting that sin out of our lives. And so sin's dark. Jesus suffered. It's not if we're going to suffer, it's when.
Yep.
So I think it's just refining our character to be more like the image of God.
Okay.
And that's it's a painful process, but it's also glorifying to him.
And it's one that, and I think you're absolutely right in everything you said, it's also one that has joy, right? I think that's the thing that is really a little bit different as Ecclesiastes gets to the end, this focus on rejoicing and light. It's been in the text before, but here he sort of focuses in on this reality of of there being the ability to actually rejoice in our life, because it is given from God. He is the one who created us. And yes, not the fall notwithstanding, it's there. There's another voice, I think, did.
Well, I was particularly somebody my age, you experience light and you experience some darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And so oftentimes in retrospect, you recognize that the dark days were what brought you closer to God, refined you, mm-hmm. and so they were beneficial.
Yeah.
And you may not see it in the middle of it, but usually in retrospect, you can you can see the value that took place and actually think, well, that was a good thing.
Yeah.
It was a really good thing that that happened.
Yeah, no, I think that's well put.
You're talking about a spiritual dimension to this,
mm-hmm.
but I'm wondering if there's just a straight physical
mm-hmm.
dimension also, talking about as people get older, things appear to be a little more dark at times. As life starts to slow down,
mm-hmm.
as people have cataracts and blindness and things like that, things become darker. I'm just wondering if they're talking about age.
So I think you're right, and actually it's funny that you bring up cataracts, because Ecclesiastes 12:3 arguably mentions cataracts. When the windows of life grow dim, which is, it's poetic language, but it's pointing to something that could be there, right? And so I think part of what Ecclesiastes is doing is saying your life, light, darkness, right, that kind of thing, it's good and bad, there's going to be this reality, but God is the one who's directing it. And the next place that he applies this, as you pick up in verse 9, is this idea of youth, right? And responding well to this reality when we're young, so that as we age, we're not sort of surprised by aging. How many of you were surprised by aging? Are surprised by aging? Yes? I think we all are to a degree, right? We're all like, oh, I know I'm going to get old. And I'm saying this as 33-year-old, I have nothing to say. But, it changes, right? Things don't, all that. So, yeah.
And this is what really struck me, this verse 9, because I'm thinking, now I know this is not true across the board for all young people, but really, you don't even consider death when you're young.
Yeah.
You're so worried about so many other things in your future. That really, of course, you should not be worrying about, making wise choices. But anyway, then there comes a certain time and you look in the mirror and you think, oh my gosh, I'm my mother. I remember exactly where I was when that happened to me.
Yeah.
And it was a transition into kind of middle age,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I think it's so true.
Yeah.
And then vanity. I have a lifelong friend. We attended her funeral this past week.
Mm-hmm.
And all is vanity.
Yeah.
And I thought, not vanity in the sense that her life wasn't, she mm-hmm. lived her life to the glory of God.
Yeah.
But it's all gone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. the eternal.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter, and we don't realize that when we're
30
years old.
Yeah.
You do, but not typically.
I think that's an absolute correct sort of way of framing this. And I think that's why Ecclesiastes in verse 9 is asking us to rejoice in our youth, right? And in a sense of taking joy in what God gives you as he gives it to you, knowing that your life is short. And this is not a sort of fatalistic thing of saying, oh, my life's short, just enjoy it. But he is saying, let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. And then he says this, and this is, we can trip over this a little bit in verse 9, walk in the way of your heart and the sight of your eyes. Now, is that good advice or bad advice?
It could be both.
It could be both, right? What does Jeremiah 17 say, right? The heart is deceitful, all of that stuff. So we know the heart's capacity for that. But in the context here, I think we're looking at it a little bit differently. The ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes. Now, these are ways and sight that should be, according to the context, according to the remembering of our Creator, and we're getting ahead, that's verse 1 of chapter 12. There's this idea that if we set our hearts and our eyes on God, then we should enjoy our youth and go and be bold and joyful. And that's a different way of looking at this, right? It says, obviously, but know that all these things God will bring into judgment. This isn't sort of a, but I'm going to get you kind of thing. God's waiting to strike you down. It's saying, be aware of consequences. Be aware of coming judgment. Be aware of those things. But if you set your course on God, then go and do the things that he wants you to do. Go and rejoice in that. Go and take joy in that. And I think that's actually a freeing way of looking at it. I've seen this passage referenced as a Christian carpe diem. That's Latin phrase, seize the day, right? Go and take life by the horns kind of thing. And this is a biblical way of saying something analogous to that, of saying if your heart is set on God, if you're going to rejoice in who he is and remember your creator, then go and do this. Verse 10, remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are vanity. Now, this isn't sort of saying live a life that has no pain in it. It's not saying sort of do that, but it's saying remove vexation from your heart. Remove the worry of life sort of wearing you down. Pain can also be translated evil there. And so it's sort of saying steer your heart away from the things that will bring worry to your life and instead pursue the things of God and rejoice in him. And now this is not just instructions to like a teenager or a 30-year-old or a 20-year-old or something like that. Even though it is geared towards the youth, it's applicable to all of us. I think there's wisdom in what Ecclesiastes is saying being applied to the youth because, why? They've got the rest of their life in front of them to live this out and to know what is true. But the same principles of how we live our life are still applicable to us if we have a decade of life left or 20 years or 40 years of life left. Whatever God will give us, we can rejoice in these days. All right, thoughts, comments, questions before we get to chapter 12? Yeah?
If you follow this advice, then you're living in a posture of gratitude.
Mm, mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. A grateful sort of dependence, knowing your days are numbered but given, right? Yeah. Any other thoughts?
Yeah. My translation says remove grief and anger from your heart.
Yeah, okay.
And I think I tend to sometimes feel sorry for myself and wallow in my pain and hold on to it like badges of honor or whatever. I'm like, this is so stupid. but it ruins the joy of every day.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a time to mourn, like we've been looking at. But there's a time to say, you know what? That hurt. That was awful.
Yeah.
And it's time to get up and move on in the Lord. It's not something that we can do ourselves.
Yeah.
But I think if we're sitting there wallowing continually in our grief or always finding something to be angry about, then it's going to ruin the time that we have on this earth.
No, I think that's really well put, and that what's beautiful about that is that's great if you can learn that when you're 15. And it's really good if you can learn when you're 62, right? They're both good, and that's the picture of this whole life lived toward God. So we've got one chapter left of Ecclesiastes, and this is everybody's favorite chapter, maybe, because it all sort of comes and we get an answer. But before we get to the last verses in chapter, or verse 9 and following, we get one more poem. It's not set off in our text as a poem, but it has this poetic element of remembering our Creator even in our youth. So the same theme is carried forward. So let me read 1-8. And honestly, just as we read this, verse 1 is going to make a lot of sense. Verse 7 and 8 are going to make sense. And the chunk in the middle, we're going to scratch our heads a little bit. Okay? Just letting you know. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth. Before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men are bent and the grinders cease because they are few, and those who look through the windows are dimmed and the doors of the street are shut, when the sound of the grinding is low and one rises up to the sound of a bird and all the daughters of song are brought low. They are afraid also of what is high. The terrors are in the way. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags itself along, and desire fails because man is going to his eternal home. And the mourners go about the streets. Before the silver cord is snapped, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. So this is a parting poem that Solomon gives us. Verse 1, I think, is really what grounds everything that follows. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth. Now, remembering here isn't just sort of a, oh yeah, I need to remember something for a test. It's sort of something that shapes us as a whole. Remember and live in light of the fact that there is a Creator. In the days of your youth, before the evil comes that is drawing near. And so remembering your Creator is sort of this really summative phrase, even as much so as the last part where it says, fear God and keep his commandments. I think this is really grounding. As we live our lives in a fallen world, we're to remember our Creator, to live like our Creator actually is there. And that's super simple, right? Everybody knows, if you've been around a church, that especially in a room like this, that there's a Creator, that we're made in his image, all of these things. But as Ecclesiastes gives us his final advice, he grounds our way of living in the world as one of remembering our Creator. I think that's really significant. What does it mean to remember? Remembering our Creator at a very fundamental level means that we are created, right? I know that's basic, but think about that we are created. And if you're created, what does that mean? You're dependent. So even here at the end, even as he's given us investment advice, so to speak, about casting our bread in the water, sort of diversifying our reality, he comes back to this reality that is to remember our Creator, that we are not self-sufficient, that we are dependent people. And so our whole life should be shaped by the truth of who God is. So remember our Creator. Before, we have no pleasure in our days. And then we get into the rest of this passage. What do you think is going on? Verses 2 through about 6.
Aging.
Yeah. Aging, okay. Yeah, there's that view. So they're probably like 12 views in what's happening here, honestly. But generally speaking, there are three. One is that it's sort of an allegorical text, and everybody who has an allegorical view of this has a different allegorical view of it. So some people mean the sun means this, and the spirit means this, and those get all kind of confusing, and I think they're self-defeating, because every person who takes an allegorical view of the text has a different allegorical view of the text, which should raise our suspicions level. So the other two maybe ways that we can take it that I think ultimately fit together, one is aging, that this is a picture of aging. And secondly, it is sort of a symbolic picture of aging and death, but also some eschatological end of the world stuff thrown in. And I think there's some things that don't neatly fit aging. And how much time do we have? Let's go through this verse by verse just to sort of understand what's going on. Verse 2, before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain. All right, so this is something coming. And this sort of, I think, sets up the eschatological sort of end of the world picture, where there is this idea of the lights that be are darkened, they're not there anymore, and clouds return after the rain. Now, the first time clouds come and give rain, it's good, right? But then what do you want to have happen? You want the sun to come out. And here's this sense that even in that moment, it doesn't fully happen. Now, that can be a sort of a picture, some poetic language for aging, but I think it's a little bit more stark than that, because some of this language of darkness and stuff is fairly indicative, or used elsewhere in Scripture, this picture of sort of clouds coming back for judgment. And so I think what Ecclesiastes is reminding us is two things. Our lives are going to come to an end, just here and now, but at the same time, the world comes to an end. And so he's putting those two things in parallel as he moves forward. And so verse 3, in the days when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men are bent and the grinders cease because they are few and those who look through windows are dimmed. Now this is where everybody has different, what does all the language mean? My favorite one is that the grinders are few. So two ways to take that. One's aging and one sort of economy is falling apart. What is the aging one?
Teeth.
Yeah, your grinders are few, which I think is just funny. That Ecclesiastes would do that at this point. And I think it's also possible that he's sort of meaning both things. It's also, the word grinders there, it can also just mean like bakers, like grinding wheat, but it also can mean sort of molars. So it kind of goes both ways. And I think that's what Ecclesiastes is drawing our attention to, is that, you know, we don't necessarily run out of teeth the same way today, because we can always just pop in some dentures or something. But in this day, right, there, you know, you ran out of teeth, you're out of teeth, and your diet changes because you're out of teeth, right? And so there is a sense of this. The windows are dimmed can mean just sort of the lights are out, right? And so you can't see as much, but it also can mean your eyesight is sort of deteriorating. Bent men are bent, sort of those are pictures of soldiers that don't have their strength. The keepers of the house are usually sort of servants who are the ones cared for it. There's fear, and this is where there's just this beautiful mix of metaphors that Ecclesiastes is drawing our attention to. Verse 4, and the doors of the street are shut when the sound of grinding is low. So possibly an economic term there, which is probably where he's going. There's not a lot of industry going on. And one rises up to the sound of a bird, and all the daughters of song are brought low.
I think if you put it towards the, I think you have to work too hard to put it towards the economy and all of that.
You think
that.
So? Yeah.
Yeah, because it's like your eyes are dim, your watchmen, the things that keep you strong or that defend you,
yeah.
Your arms shake, you have pulse. I mean, think of, we've all, you know, we're all growing older at some point,
yeah.
and you get the cataracts and you can't hear
yeah.
anything. So you get up, it's like the first light. I know.
And the birds are there, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm not an early riser, but I know that I don't sleep well at night, and so I don't get up easily in the morning. But I know so many people who are like, oh gosh,
yeah.
I woke up 4 o'clock today,
yeah.
couldn't get back
yeah.
to sleep. And yet you can't hear anything as well.
Yeah.
You know, your hearing's
yeah.
going, but you're up early, or
yeah.
the only thing you can hear is some little weird frequency.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes on here, you know, you're afraid to fall down, and you've got white hair, and you're dragging yourself along.
Yeah.
And then my mind says, yours didn't say this, but mine says the caperberry. Well,
yeah,
that
yeah, yeah.
for, you know, in the bedroom.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so it's like, it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
And you're
yeah.
talking about, you
yeah.
know, the, it's,
yeah.
I think if you're talking about anything else, I think you're having to work too
yeah.
hard.
That's
because
fair.
It has all
yeah.
of these things
yeah.
that are going on that, you know, as
yeah.
we get older,
yeah.
everything quits working.
Yeah. No, I think it's, and that's why I do think there, but there are enough notes, and it's interesting, translations are different, right? How many of you had the caperberry in your translation?
Where is it?
It would be, the ESV has desire fails.
Verse 5.
Yeah.
In the middle of it, yeah, after the grasshopper drags himself along.
Desire
yeah.
fails. Yeah.
Desire fails.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, that's just a weird, so caperberry, everybody reads that and is like, I don't know what that is. So there, so a caperberry is a berry, and it was used as a aphrodisiac, or had that thought behind it. And so the sense is that's not even working anymore. People are getting old, I think is the sense that it's quite literally said. And the almond tree blossoms, this is where I think there is a little bit of compelling thing, because an almond tree, the idea is that you kind of like get white hair. Does anybody have a translation that says white hair? No, almond blossom. The other thing, though, is that Jeremiah 1:9-12 talks about almond branches sort of sprouting as a mark of God's judgment. And so that's where I think it is about aging, but I think there's enough of these other little notes to say there's a little bit more going on. Not that it makes a huge difference in our final sort of interpretation of the text.
You know, part of the lampstand has almond branches on it. In the temple,
mm-hmm.
temple, right?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, and that does bring up the next verse, which probably has the most debate on it, verse 6. And maybe some of you are totally bored at this point, saying, why are we still talking about this? But it's just, it's fascinating when God gives us passages like this, I think. Yeah, Mary Jane.
So just a thought,
mm-hmm.
So we're body and spirit, so aging of our body, but
mm-hmm.
is it also referring to God's redemptive plan reaching you know, the new heaven and the new earth? I don't know. It could.
I think so, and you could maybe find a note of that in verse 7, right? If you jump down there, the dust returns to the earth as what is in the spirit returns to the God who gave it. But even there, as Ecclesiastes has used that language so far, it hasn't been with great hope. It's not like the spirit returns to God and there's this joy. In a sense, if we just leave it there, that's not a full picture of redemption, right? Because the body is redeemed, right? And so he isn't really, I don't think, getting into maybe the hope, so to speak, but just the reality that things slowly wear out. So verse 6, there's this silver cord is snapped, the golden bowl is broken, and the pitcher is shattered. What is going on? Anybody want to hazard a guess? There are obviously different ideas behind this. Some people see it as sort of a picture of the wealth of the court is sort of falling apart, gold and silver. Other people see it really, all these things as pictures of the water production, silver cord. Other people see it as a picture of a lamp being sort of held up by a silver cord that then falls and shatters. This is one of that just seems to be a general picture of decay and destruction, I think is the easiest way to take it. The wheel is broken at the cistern.
Is there any connection with the temple?
Possibly, although the temple stuff doesn't have silver in its lampstands and things, and so some people have tried to argue that, but it doesn't fit. You can't fit the silver cord and stuff into that. And so this is one of those notes that I think doesn't as neatly fit an aging paradigm. And all this to say, what is the conclusion of this poem before we bore us all to tears? If you're really excited, let's talk more about it later. Yeah.
I think it's the end of life. Life's
yeah.
over.
Yeah.
Your pitcher's crushed. It's gone.
Yeah.
The cistern's crushed.
Mm-hmm.
The everything's shattered. It's done.
Yeah.
It's over.
There's nothing left, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the grinders, whether they are teeth or bakers, have ceased. There's no water. This your very life source is gone, right? And so this is where we are left. The dust returns to the earth. Spirit returns. And so there's vanity of vanities. And so this is sort of a summative thing that we're given, right? Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. And this is where he started and where he ends with this idea of vanity, verse chapter 1. And now at the end of 12, this sort of is this nice bookend. And what we're told so far is to rejoice and remember. Those are our two sort of imperatives coming out of this passage so far. We rejoice and remember. And yet there's a little bit more that he's going to give us in this text. Even as we begin this process of rejoicing and remembering, we're given a little bit more grounding in these last verses. Before I read them, any last thing on verses 1 through 8 of 12?
You kind of hear that Kansas song, Dust in the Wind, playing in the background.
Yeah. Dust. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We got speakers, we could play it. It absolutely, this sort of frailty, right? But with a little bit more hope than he's had at other points in the text,
sure.
Right? But there, you're absolutely right, that's the, you know, the playlist. If you had to write a playlist for this song, right, or this book, you'd probably put songs like that in it.
Simon and Garfunkel.
Yeah.
Simon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We could.
I'm just kidding.
You know. No.
No, we're gonna think of this passage every time we hear those songs.
Yeah, that's good. That's an intentional pedagogical move, right? When you connect a song to something or a life experience to something, every time you're in that situation, it comes back. All right. Let's pick up verse 9. Fear God and keep His commandments. Besides being wise, now this is sort of a, some people read this and say, oh, this is just a later addition to the text. There's no manuscript evidence that would give us that view. The only reason people would say that is because of maybe a little bit of the tone, and it is a postscript, if you will, but there's no reason to discount it as being original. Verse 9, besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They are given by one shepherd. My son, beware of anything beyond these. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. All right, there it is, the conclusion of the matter. And we get a little bit of sort of context for Solomon and the preacher and what he's doing here, this sort of arranging of knowledge, sort of he's considered all these things, He's giving them to us. And a couple things to note. I think verse 10 is helpful. Sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. There's this picture of, I mean, if you've ever put words to paper, what a goal. Words of truth and ones that are words of delight. And I think we see that even in his attention to these images and stuff to sort of capture our hearts and move us towards what is true. Yeah.
This whole thing reminds me of a phone call I had this week from my brother. He was going, he listed every death of all grandparents and when they died. And it was just this horrible,
loves a funeral.
Oh my gosh.
It's a funeral.
And then at the end he goes, but I know where I'm going.
Yeah.
I go, well, good, Jim.
Yeah. Let's talk about that.
This whole thing reminds me of that phone call.
Yeah.
Because it was all downer.
Yeah.
We're all going to die and this is the time. And then he goes, but I know where I'm going. He said, well, that's the best part, Jim.
Yeah. And in a sense, Ecclesiastes is saying is know all that death, but then go live, rejoice, and fear God and do the things he asks us to.
Yeah,
and I think that's a good real-life application. Other things you notice. All right, so we've seen sort of his beauty and truth. Verse 11, the words of the wise are like goads. We know what goads are, right? Somebody who sort of prods somebody along, which speaks to conviction. And then conviction of sin, conviction of wrong living. And nails firmly fixed, sort of truth, something that we can anchor ourselves to or be anchored by. And then this key phrase, they are given by one shepherd. Now, who's the one shepherd?
God.
Yeah, and it's not just sort of us reading with New Testament eyes. This was language that would have caused people to see that there is truth here. Where do we see that? We see it a few places in Psalm 23, right? The Lord is my shepherd. There's an idea of shepherding, and the singularity of shepherd here is a clear indication of a divine shepherd, God the Father. And then it is appropriate to see how this language is picked up in the New Testament, right? The one whose wisdom is even greater than Solomon in Jesus, who says he is a shepherd. And so we can take some hope in that reality as well. I think there's also, verse 12, this idea of beware of anything beyond these, of making many books, there is no end, and such study is weariness of the flesh. It's not wrong to read books. It's not saying that. It's not wrong to sort of engage in scholarship and all those sorts of things. But you also know there's a sense that books tend to say the same things. So if you take 20 books on Christian maturity and you scan them all, 80% of the content is probably the same. Now, it doesn't mean it's not important. It doesn't mean that how that particular author wrote something doesn't uniquely connect to certain people and help them understand and all of that. But there is a sense to say we're not creating new truth. We're just clarifying and applying it in ways that then need to happen. And so in a sense, it's saying rest in the answers that Scripture gives. Don't go on this journey of endless questioning. C.S. Lewis in The Great Divorce, might get some of these details a little bit wrong, but has this picture of, if you've read the book, it's sort of this field trip to heaven and hell and all this stuff, right? And there's this, and they're on a bus, and it's typical sort of picture of what Lewis would do. But there's this individual, as they are nearing heaven, and this individual sort of invited to come and experience the reality of heaven and to see God, even Lewis says, and all of this wonderful stuff. And the guy's like, I don't really know. I've got questions. And the conclusion of it basically is he doesn't want to be certain about things. And so he goes back to, Lewis says, his discussion group in hell. What is Lewis's point there? Various points. But one of the things is that there is this truth, this journey that some people love Ecclesiastes because it's just like, what does it mean, right? But here at the end, he says, it's okay to ask those questions, but you also need to arrive somewhere.
Yeah.
And there are things that you can be fixed to. It doesn't mean everything makes sense. It's okay to have questions and to wrestle with things and those realities, but there is a fixedness of these collected sayings, which
I'd
come
like,
from the one shepherd.
I'd like to say the studying, you get too wound up in that, and then you're in danger of having itching ears.
Yeah.
Journaling is a good thing, but you can start telling yourself lies in your journal and elevating it
yeah.
to almost a worship item.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's telling us the journey is important,
mm-hmm.
but the destination
yeah.
is your goal, not
yeah.
the journey.
Yeah, and I think it's okay, absolutely right, and to say we have arrived at our destination, even if some of us still needs to catch up,
mm-hmm.
right? In a sense,
yeah.
that's what Ecclesiastes is saying, is here is your destination. There's lots of life that isn't fully there yet, but here in God is the one that you have, the one that we remember as our creator, the one shepherd. And so there's a note of warning, so to speak, there in that verse there. All right, verse 13, the end of the matter, all has been heard. And what he's saying there is he's tried everything, in a sense. He's considered things, he's worked through life, he's done things that you and I may not have the opportunity to do and to consider. And so he says, fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. And this now is more traditional Proverbs kind of language, right? How does Proverbs instruct us to fear God? That's the beginning of knowledge, beginning of wisdom and knowledge is to fear God. And so Ecclesiastes arrives at this point, but in a much different way than some of the Proverbs do. Rather than starting with it, he ends with it, and he brings us to this point. Now, just an interesting aspect in the text here. How many of your translations have something different than the whole duty of man? I know we probably only have maybe four or five translations represented here.
You're talking in verse 13?
Verse 13, yeah.
I have keep his commandments.
Keep his commandments, okay.
Well, this is the whole duty.
Whole duty of man.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is going to sound like I spent a lot of time on this. I spent 4 minutes on this, but I looked at 55 different translations. It's really easy to do with software. I didn't sit there with 55 Bibles turning to Ecclesiastes. 55 translations, 25 of them have something about duty. And I think that's a correct way to understand the text. Although in the Hebrew text, the word duty isn't there. It just says it is the whole of man. That's sort of a literal wooden translation. It is the whole of man. And so there are a number of translations that actually just leave it like that. And I think in it, and I don't think it's necessary. Why am I bringing all this up? We have full confidence in the Bible that's in front of us. I'm not disparaging that. But often when we hear the end of Ecclesiastes, we say, all right, it's time to shape up and do what God told me to do, right? Now, that is our duty, right? But the sense of duty here is more closely aligned with purpose, because the word duty isn't directly in the text. It is the whole of man. It is our purpose. We are commanded to do it, but it's what we were created to do. So as we remember our creator, remember our purpose. So I'm not saying anything different, but I know what it's like to hear this and sort of come to the end of the text and say, all right, we considered all of this, now just do what you're told. That's not what Ecclesiastes is saying. It's saying, consider all of this and know your true purpose, where you find meaning and fulfillment and all of the things that you've been looking for that have been vanity. Know it's found in doing what God has called you to do, because that's what you were created for. And so that's the beauty of the invitation at the end of the book, is to say, be who God created you to be. Live the way God created life to work. And so that's the sense that I think we need to sort of draw out in this last verse. The whole man, the whole duty that we have, the thing that is good for us, is to fear God, which in this context, again, is not one of just sort of trepidation and fear of judgment, although judgment is, we're cognizant of that, but especially through Jesus, we hear fear of God, and we know it is one of reverence and dependence on him, knowing that he is the God who judges, but also gives grace and keep his commandments. So it's a relational response to God as the one who is holy, the one who is the covenant God. And then there is also the reality of then doing what he asks us to do, motivated by love, motivated by the reality that he is a God who has cared for us and drawn us to himself. We'll have some discussion in a moment about what we've learned, so to speak, but. T.S. Eliot, the poet, in his book, or The Four Quartets, one of his poems, says this, and these are probably words you've heard before, but I think they fit with what we see in Ecclesiastes. He says, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and to know the place for the first time." And in a sense, that's what Ecclesiastes is doing. We're kind of back where we started, quite literally when he talks about vanity, but we know the place better. We know what vanity is and what it isn't. We know that there is hope. We know that there is a God. We know there's a creator to remember and rejoice in, even as we do the fullness of our purpose, the duty that God has placed us on earth to have, to fear him and to keep his commandments. So that's Ecclesiastes. We have a few moments. What have, you know, as we sort of circle the wagons, so to speak, what have you noticed in Ecclesiastes now or previously? Why do you think this book is helpful? What have you learned? Yeah.
I think what you just shared kind of gave me a new look at this.
Yeah.
Duty being better translated as purpose.
Yeah.
When you do something out of duty, you check a box.
Mm-hmm.
When you do something because you feel like that's your purpose in life,
yeah,
there's joy and there's meaning.
Yeah.
And I think that's what our salvation by grace,
mm-hmm,
gives us.
Yeah.
We're not just checking a box,
yeah, yeah,
like Pharisees,
yeah,
but we're doing it with purpose,
yeah,
for God's glory.
Yeah.
You know, because we love him,
mm-hmm,
it's not just the box checking.
Absolutely. So. Yeah. And to use that language of shepherding, right? We hear the voice of our shepherd,
yeah,
because he has called us and we love him, right? And that moves us in that grace-motivated way that you're describing. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah,
I'll preface this by saying Charlene and I live in Morningside,
yeah,
Ministries, which is a retirement community. We have about 350 people in there,
mm-hmm,
at any one time. The ambulance comes in there at least twice a week,
yeah,
to take somebody out.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
looking at this chapter 12 and reading about,
yeah,
grinding teeth and,
yeah,
and everything, when you get to our age and are exposed to it 24/7,
mm-hmm,
like we are, it makes you think that this chapter 12 is sort of a textbook or a required textbook reading for young people,
yeah,
and people of middle age.
Yeah.
It should make you understand your parents,
yeah,
a lot better,
yeah,
when they are in that situation.
For sure.
And it will certainly prepare you for life when you get to our age, like,
yeah,
they was mentioning.
Yeah.
And I think it's a textbook. Everything,
mm-hmm,
that he says in here, from your eyesight going,
yeah,
if you go to dinner in our dining room, it's the loudest dining room. I mean, it puts teenagers,
yeah,
to shame. Because we're all hollering.
Yeah.
This should be required,
yeah,
reading,
yeah,
for young people,
yeah,
and people,
mm-hmm,
who have parents that,
mm-hmm,
are approaching our age.
Yeah.
It follows it word by word.
Yeah. Yeah, and to do that with grace and to respect each other in that various stages. No, I think that's
right.
Helpful. Yeah, Dave.
To me, in very simplified terms, Ecclesiastes is balance principles for life, because it balances. When you're in the down and whatever, and it can show you where there's hope, and it,
yeah,
and if you're on a high, it can show you it's not always going to be high.
Yeah.
And so it's good balance principles for life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Setting our expectations, right? Even knowing what aging looks like before it comes and those sorts of things. Yeah.
I think my, when I was trying to figure out where you were talking about duty, because mine does not say it.
Yeah, yeah.
Mine says, instead of just keep his commandments, because this applies to every person.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't just something that, I mean, this is God's wisdom that even people who don't know God can follow, and it would,
yeah,
be a wise way of doing things. And
yeah, it's how life works,
yeah,
right? And if we remember our Creator, of course the Creator is the one who understands how life works, right? So this reality, and that's why a lot of it, sometimes people say it's common grace wisdom, right? It's things that apply even outside of salvation, right? Is it good to diversify your investments? Yes, right? There's a biblical reason for that. But yeah, absolutely, it's this holistic, it's everybody. And it actually can be a, sometimes it actually works as an evangelistic book in that regard, because it allows people to see, just, most people don't think a book like Ecclesiastes is in the Bible, right? If you start giving them, other than chapter 3, right? Because everybody knows that, time for everything, because there's music about it, but it really exposes things that everybody is dealing with and then grounds them in this is what God made you for. And so it actually has some evangelistic teeth to it. But any other thoughts?
Well, this was very valuable to me because I always thought they were chummy when they threw bread on the water. And thinking like a fisherman.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that you can read this your whole life long,
mm-hmm.
and it has different applications for you
mm-hmm.
in the different seasons.
Yeah. And that's the fruitfulness of God's word, right? And will not return to him void. Yeah. Well, I've enjoyed wandering at times through Ecclesiastes with you, because that's sometimes how I think this book is best understood. And so, yeah, just to sum up, I think there is, and we didn't talk about this maybe as much as we could have, but all of what Ecclesiastes is longing for, right, is fulfilled in Jesus. And I know we sort of played lip service to that at the end of some classes, but that really is, as we read the fullness of Scripture, especially in that language of one shepherd, we know the full and perfect shepherd who has fulfilled everything that we long for here, right? And again, with Ecclesiastes, that is in part now and in full later, but there is this reality, even as we get to the end of this, that Jesus is the one that makes verse 13 make a whole lot more sense. Verse 14, for God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil, which is a picture of God intimately connected to the details of our life, right? How does Jesus talk about that same thing, right? A sparrow will not fall,
mm-hmm.
right? The hairs of our head are numbered. And so there's a picture of God's attentive awareness of that, but also for us who are redeemed through Jesus, we know that this picture, verse 14, is one of God's great love for us and care. And so even when life seems to be vain, we have a God who knows us and cares for us. So let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for giving us a book like Ecclesiastes in your wisdom. Lord, would we follow what is instructed here, that we would do our duty? Would we fulfill our purpose, as it were, to keep your commandments and fear you? Lord, would we know that that is what it means to rejoice in you, to remember the God of our creation, the one who has made us? Lord, would you fill us with your hope? The power of Jesus, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.